Hello, and welcome to the Classicist Podcast from the Hoover Institution. I'm your host, Troy Sinek, and the classicist is Victor Davis Hanson, the Martin and Ely Anderson Senior Fellow at the Hoover Institution. And Victor, this is the first show that you and I have been able to do since the events between the U.S. and Iran. And rather than just picking up from where we are today, I'd like to start by having you break down the component parts of what got us here. And let me start with the event that immediately preceded the strike that killed Soleimani. This was the attack, I don't know if you'd call it botched, but it was mostly warded off, that was attempted on the American embassy in Baghdad, with the Iranians largely driving it. So what do you take as the Iranian calculation there? They've been provocative for a while now with us, with the Saudis. What's your read on why they were willing to go in on an attack on American interests like this, knowing the kind of response it might engender?
Well, two observations in answer. One, I'm not sure they knew exactly what Trump was going to do, because remember, they had shot down a multi-million dollar drone and we didn't do anything, and Trump had displayed magnanimity, and they took that as weakness, and rather than gratitude to be reciprocated. And then the second precursor to this is they are minus 12 GDP, and it's not a static situation. So in their view, they have to do something, and they have a range of options. They can do a big something and attack us here in the U.S. with terrorists, I suppose, or in Europe. Or they can do this tit-for-tat in Middle East, against Middle East bases. Or they can hasten their enrichment program. Or they can go back to the table. And they've decided that all of those are not possible. So they've chosen the safest, and that is to kind of get us into a tit-for-tat Afghan war, no-fly zone during the 90s type of irascinating cycle. And so when they did this, I don't think they thought Trump was really serious. And they have reason to believe that he wouldn't be, because Obama had the red lines, and then he had been forgiving about the drone attack. And then when he did that, I think they were shocked, because Soleimani thought he was sacrosanct. And now they're looking at all of the alternatives. And Trump, to be frank, has all the cards, because he can do nothing. And each day their economy worsens. And now the Europeans are talking about joining in with the sanctions. And so I expect they're going to have to do something. And from what we know of that regime, it won't be honest. It'll be disingenuous. It'll be subversive, but they will try to do something to break this stranglehold on their economy.
Let's talk about the actual strike that killed Soleimani. I confess that you were the first person that I thought of when I heard the news, because just a few weeks prior, you and I had a conversation on this podcast in which you, one, predicted that Iran was going to lash out and up the ante a bit, and two, that President Trump would react with disproportionate force. This is the classic Jacksonian formulation. I'll leave you alone, but the second you start trying to play in my yard, I'm going to bring the hammer down. And, Victor, there was, I think it's fair to say, some breathlessness about this decision, especially in the way it was covered by the press. People saying the president's going to get us into World War III. He's going to destabilize the region. You heard the news that Soleimani had been killed, and your first reaction was what?
Well, I wrote an article, I think, almost immediately saying that we had all the cards to play, as I said, and that once we had done that, the world now would look at Iran and see what they were going to do because of their braggadocio and the Hezbollah and death to America. And I said, Trump obviously has a list of targets that he can attack and take out without loss to ourselves, and he can sit back and just go down the list, and each one of them were billion-dollar targets. And they will do some iconic response, but not any that involve material damage, because he'll just go down his target list. And they know that, and they're frustrated. They've lost face among their supporters. Moderate Iranians are happy over the assassination, targeted killing. Arabs are happy. Israelis are happy. Europeans are happy. The only people that seem to be upset are the left in the United States and the left in Europe. perhaps because since the Obama administration, as you remember, the Green Revolution of 2009, whenever there's a popular uprising against the regime, they worry because they have this very distorted view of a revolutionary regime that they can do business with, they can have a landmark agreement with, and it never quite works with them. And so Obama did not want to support mass uprisings because he thought the regime would survive and then they would not cut an Iran deal with him. And the left, I guess, is still delusional and thinks if that regime survives, then they can go back and do an Iran deal 2.0.
So the reprisal from the Iranians after the Soleimani killing is them firing from Iranian territory missiles at American installations in Iraq. There are no casualties. And in fact, a lot of observers interpreted this as more of a face-saving exercise than anything, as you say. And the president comes out the next day and says the Iranians are standing down. The idea is we've kind of reached an equilibrium here. How steady do you take that equilibrium to be? Is this Iran really taking a substantive step back, or is this Iran biding its time?
I think they're going to bide their time 3 weeks, 4 weeks to 2 or 3 months till the smoke clears, and then they're going to say, was this a one-off thing? And they're going to do something like that. Something like they have done in the past. They'll kill an American or they'll attack a base. We don't really know whether these huge rockets that hit the base were deliberately aimed or if they had that capability not to hit Americans. But they came pretty close and they did a lot of damage. And Trump could have responded, but it gave him a weird opportunity to show magnanimity. And he can say, well, no Americans were killed. I'm giving them one more chance. So now the ball is in their court. And after that tragedy of the Ukrainian airliner and their lies about it and the disruption that followed, they're going to have to make a decision. But we should keep in mind, again, that it's not static, that the domestic situation is volatile, and they're getting poor and going broke quicker every day. And they're going to have to do something, and we're going to have to be ready for that something. The same applies to North Korea, and not in an existential sense, but to China as well, because all three of those regimes see the status quo is not sustainable from their point of view.
Once the missiles started getting exchanged, Iran announced that it was withdrawing from the nuclear deal. Now, of course, the Trump administration had exited it a while ago, but Iran was still officially a participant, along with some of the allies who joined onto that agreement when it was originated during the Obama administration. Question I put to you, without being flippant, does it matter? Does it make a real-world difference that Iran has officially disclaimed this agreement, especially when the argument you've made before is that this agreement was never going to accomplish much of our long-term goals anyway?
It only does because the Europeans now will have a pretext to start joining the United States in boycotting and having sanctions, and they were afraid they were going to do it anyway. I think Trump had sort of hinted that he wanted a secondary boycott, that he would boycott countries that were doing business, and that scared a lot of people. So I think they felt they had to preempt the European decision to save face. But they had violated, we know from the Israeli raid in the documents that came back, they'd violated enrichment levels, they had violated processed uranium levels, they had violated places where centrifuges were supposedly not being activated, and they were. And so they always looked at this as 10 years to bank money when the sanctions were called off and to bank accumulated expertise, and then they were going to unleash it and say, okay, we have a bomb, and what are you going to do about it? We couldn't do anything about it. So, and then I think Lee Smith was prominent in a series of articles at the time and then recently that the whole Iran deal was designed for two reasons. One, to make sure they didn't get a bomb on Obama's 8-year watch, and two, in some misplaced, incoherent, crazy idea that you were going to balance our Arab moderate friends in the Gulf and Israel by empowering the Shia Persian crescent in Lebanon, Yemen, Syria, and of course in Iran. And then that would create a tension in which the United States could withdraw. And I think that was the idea. And I think their sympathies of the last administration were with Iran rather than with Israel and Saudi Arabia or Kuwait and those countries. And that was a disastrous decision. And it gave Iran a lot of money. It gave them a lot of false notions about U.S. deterrence, and it caused a lot of damage. And you can tell that it did because we now have a shadow government in British style that's on the airwaves and television almost nonstop. John Kerry, Ben Rhodes, social media, Susan Rice, all desperate to show us that they didn't appease Iran. And of course they did, and the next 6 weeks is going to be very bad for them in the news cycle. It's going to show what they did, I think.
The final question that I'll put to you, how should we think about the health of the Iranian regime? I mean, as you mentioned, there are pretty widespread protests now, some of the reporting indicating that it's spreading to areas where you didn't see it before. And I guess you could say it was catalyzed by the shoot down of the airplane. But as you mentioned, we've seen this before. We saw it with the Green Revolution 10 years ago. We saw it more recently when they started cutting the gasoline subsidies. So how precarious do you take their hold on power to be? And if we were to imagine a scenario where that regime was to topple, how would you think about the future prospects for the country?
Well, I mean, totalitarian regimes, and that's what it is. It's a theocracy and something analogous to the secular totalitarian regime in Venezuela. They, because they say they're doing it for the people, they have lots more, they're a lot more ready to use the power at their disposal to kill people. The Shah was discredited. It was a kleptomaniac dynasty, family dynasty, and he was out. These guys have been in for 40 years, and they know that people hate them, and they're corrupt, but they're deeply embedded throughout society. And so the question is, how many people are they going to kill? And they've killed 1,500 of them in the last couple of months. So I imagine that people in the street know that if they're going to go out there and try to remove this regime, they're perfectly willing and capable of killing tens of thousands of Iranians. And it's just a question of how bad the economy gets. And when people get so desperate, they say, I can't go on like this, and we'll see. But there's one thing else that the mullahs and the permanent religious bureaucracy is widely despised. And if that government is overthrown, unlike the Shah, there's going to be very few people that want to take this regime. I can't think of anybody, North Korea or Castro. I don't know, Castro. Who would the Castro? I don't know. Who would take them? And so they're thinking that if we lose power, we're going to be dead. Sort of like Muammar Gaddafi's regime. So I think it'll be an existential and long drawn out war. And I think it's a 50-50 chance that they'll make it through the year.
All right. You've been listening to the Classicist Podcast with Victor Davis Hanson. Remember, you can read all of Victor's work at victorhanson.com and follow him on Twitter at VDHanson. And if you enjoy the show, please rate it on iTunes or wherever you get your podcasts. For Victor Davis Hanson, I'm Troy Senek. Thanks for listening.
This podcast has been a production of the Hoover Institution. For more information about our work, please visit hoover.org.